Hello, sex fans. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, June 11th, 2014, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. And I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. Benjamin Law, the author of the critically acclaimed book Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East, is back with us for part two of his turn on this, the Sex Wisdom Show. I'm so glad that he has more time to spend with us again this week because he charmed the pants off of me last week. Well, so to speak. But wait! You didn't miss part one of this conversation, did you? Well, not to worry if you did, because you can find it and all of my podcasts in the podcast archive on my site, drdicksexadvice.com. All you got to do is use the search function in the header, type in podcast number 419, and voila! But don't forget to use the pound sign when you do your search. And I'm sure we'll have another opportunity to hear Benjamin read from his book. Benjamin invites you to visit him on his website, benjamin-law.com, and you can find him on Twitter, too. For your convenience, I've included these links in today's podcast posting. Today's show is once again brought to you by the granddaddies of male masturbation toys, the amazing Fleshlight and Fleshjack. For those of you who have never seen one of these brilliant devices, let me describe it to you. It looks like a huge flashlight. Thus the very clever names, don't you know? Inside the durable plastic case, there is a soft, fleshy inside called Super Skin. And trust me, this stuff is aptly named. It's phenomenal. But that's just the beginning. What makes the Fleshlight and Fleshjack so freaking amazing is that you get to design and personalize just about every aspect of the unit you purchase. Now, what other toy company allows you to do that? And remember, if you make your purchase by clicking on the Fleshjack banner in the sidebar of drdicksexadvice.com, a portion of that sale will come back to us as support for these shows. Now, you can help underwrite this important sex-positive effort and squeeze one out at the same time. What could be better than that? Okay, on with the show. Benjamin Law, welcome back to DrDickSexAdvice.com for this second part of our conversation for the Sex Wisdom series. Good to have you back. I so enjoyed our chat last week, and I'm glad that you could make more time for us today.
I'm really grateful that you were able to make the time. Thanks, Dr. Dick.
So we were talking at the end of last week's show about how some gay and lesbian people cope, and oftentimes in traditional cultures they have to engage in sham marriages, either forced upon them or chosen to save face in their families. Is there a lot of that? You mentioned China last year. Is that as well in India or any of the other places you visited?
Well, I mean, looking at China specifically, someone told me a quote that has sort of stuck with me, and they said, if you're an adult male in China, an adult gay male in China, you are going to get married one way or another. And that, of course, isn't same-sex marriage, which isn't legal in China.
Yes.
But you are either going to get married in a sham marriage, so you both go into it knowing that it is a sham, or you might get married to a woman who doesn't know that you're gay and you will never tell her, even though you do. Or, of course, there are people who end up in marriages not even knowing that themselves, that they are gay themselves, that they've denied it and pushed it down. Right. They're in the closet to themselves, right. And therefore, of course, their wife doesn't know either. So there are all these different levels. And when you think about it, that doesn't sound so peculiar. I think a generation ago, and probably even now, so many people in the West will get married trying to, you know, really repress a part of themselves, their sexuality. So, of course, it happens in China. It happens elsewhere as well, throughout Asia, throughout the world. But I think what's different in China is that there is this growing gay consciousness so people understand who they are, that is still growing alongside very, very important central traditions of getting married by a certain age as well. How do they negotiate that? That's how sham marriages come up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So Christian, Muslim, and Hindu fundamentalists believe that homosexuality can be cured.
Oh, they sure can. Yeah, they sure do.
There's no proof of that, of course, but that's what they believe. And I guess in this instance, the same is true all over the world.
Yeah, look, I mean, I started writing this book several years back, and even though I'm looking at people who believe in reparative homosexuality therapies, in an Asian context, and I do look at three different figures in India and Malaysia, so looking at people who claim you can be cured of homosexuality through the power of Christ, through the power of Allah, and through, in India, the power of yoga. So, Richard, if you've got tight hamstrings, you know where that's leading to.
There you go.
Yeah, and of course that's not actually something that's just located in Asia at all. We hear instances of it in Africa. Before I started writing this book, I was documenting how religious fundamentalist Christian groups are doing it in Australia,
absolutely.
For instance.
Yes.
And that's not, I mean, that's out in the suburbs of Melbourne. Melbourne is one of the most metropolitan, progressive cities in Australia, and yet you don't have to go far out to find church groups advocating that you can be cured of your affliction through the power of God. But I wanted to look at these culturally specific examples of people doing it in Asia.
Right. And in Africa, for example, you know, a lot of the really horrible, repressive, anti-gay laws, you know, kill the gay laws and stuff like that, they're all instigated by American evangelists. And, you know, they're losing ground, the cultural wars in America, and so they're going to Africa and trying to win there. It's frightful.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a pretty dark situation in a lot of African nations where, you know, as we now know, corrective rapes against lesbians have been carried out so long, which is absolutely horrendous. Yes. And you're also right in pointing out that as these fundamentalist religious groups are losing currency and losing their viability in many Western nations, like the United States, like Australia, they move elsewhere where they can have influence, like Africa and very much like Asia as well, whether it's the people coming over and doing the work themselves, or they're giving, you know, the native people, the people on the ground, the tools in order to carry out their work further.
Right. And it all smacks of colonialism, it seems to me, because the little bit that I know of a lot of traditional cultures is that there's room for, you know, sexual diversity to some degree, and then, you know, this other presence, either be it religious or socioeconomic in terms of colonialism, comes in and, you know, adds this repression and oppression that just changes everything.
Well, I think that you're really hitting the nail on the head, because there's a broader argument here too. When you look at a country like India and what they're trying to overturn at the moment, which is Section 377, which is an old colonial law in India that outlaws homosexuality. Now, this was dismantled in the Delhi High Court, and then it's actually been upheld in the Indian Supreme Court.
Yes.
So as of now, homosexuality is still illegal. But there is a really strong case to be built that in a lot of these societies, prior to colonialism, there was a cultural space for homosexual and transgender identities and homosexual relationships. When the British came in with religion as well, it shifted those attitudes towards sexual relationships to something else. And those sort of attitudes, those laws especially that legislate against homosexuality in Africa, in a country like India, the old colonies, they are very much directly a result of colonialism. So there's something to be explored in that sense too.
Right. It's the same thing happened in the colonization of the Americas. You know, the native peoples had, in some instances, a reverence for like sexually not male or female personalities, and they were shamanic personalities in the tribe and culture. But all, of course, that was stamped out. So,
sure.
But despite the obvious oppression in many of these countries, there is also an amazing expression of the resiliency of the LGBT community in each. And I'm thinking of the transgendered beauty pageants in Thailand, pride marches in other countries. What do you make of this? And are these expressions portents of things to come?
I think in some cases it is. I think in India especially, you know, it was my first, I'm ashamed to say slightly, the pride parade that I document in Bombay, which was the second ever pride parade that they'd ever had there, was my first ever pride march. You know, I was well into my 20s and I hadn't even attended a pride march up until that point. And
we're going to take your gay card away.
I know. But I feel like I've earned my license back. But there it was, you know, just like the fight to dismantle Section 377, it was an alliance of so many disparate groups, from the hijras, or what we would call transgender women of India, to lesbian and gay groups, to also straight HIV activists as well. And there's only a growing discussion and a growing consciousness of what of LGBT rights. So you've got a lot of high-profile Indian celebrities aligning themselves with the movement as well. There's almost, you know, a Castro vibe, Harvey Milk era vibe going on in India at the moment. But then you've got other societies where that sort of our idea of what LGBT pride looks like doesn't really quite align to what can be expressed in the culture. Like, for instance, in China, where you can't protest. You know, it's illegal to protest in this communist country. Protest as we know it doesn't exist. So the LGBT movement there is much more quieter and much more polite. And it's much more, in terms of political lobbying, it's more done behind closed doors, under the auspices of HIV organizations, under the umbrella push for health rights instead of civil rights. And then, for instance, in Thailand, the whole ladyboy beauty pageants that you mentioned, which are really mainstream events, Richard. You know, they're actually broadcast out into Thailand, the equivalent of a third of the Oscar viewers in the United States view this beauty pageant in Thailand as well. The winners end up getting beauty endorsement deals and roles on TV shows. That's seen as a huge thing over there. But of course, that could arguably be a different thing as well. Even though it gives these women the platform to talk about transgender rights in their country, it's very much a commercial product as well. These women are there to really push sponsors, really. So there's a whole other economic dimension there too.
Right. Could I prevail upon you to read again from your book? Last week I enjoyed so much what you had to say about Bali.
Mm-hmm. Well, where should we go this time? I feel like we're looking at a map of the world and it's like, which country should we visit? Look, you did mention at the start of the interview that I looked at people who are trying to cure people out of their homosexuality,
right.
Which of course is a really grim subject matter to look at. But of course, when you start documenting the people who are behind some of these programs, it can get unintentionally darkly comic as well. So I'm going to take you to the city of Malacca, which is in Malaysia. I'm going to take you to a place called Real Love Ministry, which is a church that's dedicated to healing people out of their brokenness. And it's run by someone named Pastor Edmund. At 10 o'clock on a Sunday, the canal-lined streets of Malacca were unusually quiet, but the Real Love Ministry had already started its morning service. On the walls of the building stairwell, glittery craft letters spelled out Real Heart and www.rlm.com, and soft rock melodies wafted through the building. I took off my shoes, opened the doors, and was immediately knocked back by the force of song. There were just 20 people in the room, mostly adults, some kids, a couple of elderly ladies, who all smiled at me, still singing, as I entered. A small band led the hymns on electric guitars, drums, and bass, while a rosy-cheeked Chinese-Malaysian woman named Judith sang into the mic. Now, unusually, I was uncomfortable with public singing unless I was drunk, but this song that I was singing was infuriatingly catchy, and it featured hand claps, and any song that features prominent hand claps tends to win me over. RLM's church was the size of a standard classroom, and ambience-wise, it was more like a corporate call centre than a sacred place of worship. The hospital-grade fluoro lighting made it feel antiseptic, but the smiles and songs warmed the place right up. It was easy to spot Pastor Edmund and his wife, Amanda. They were standing in the front row, dancing to the music and singing the loudest. I'd recognise them from a Malaysian Women's Weekly profile I'd read online, branded with the headline, "True Confession, my husband only liked men until he met me. Is this Malaysia's most controversial marriage?" The story's lead read, "Until 12 years ago, Edmund Smith led a homosexual lifestyle. Now he's happily married and a father of two. Here's the story of his remarkable journey." In fact, Edmund had gone on to build his entire career around his story of sexual brokenness, traveling throughout Malaysia and preaching his good news of sexual metamorphosis, insisting anyone could change. He had no less than 3 Facebook pages dedicated to his work. On his personal Facebook page, Edmund used the relationship feature to list all his friends as his brothers, sisters, cousins, spiritual children, and spiritual grandchildren. He also listed his favourite shows. They included American Idol, Glee, Desperate Housewives, and Oprah. I'll leave it there.
Is he Caucasian?
No. I mean, he's ethnic Malay.
I see. With a name like that, very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But as the chapter goes on, we delve into his history as well. And though I start from a funny place, as I often try to do, we do end up into the stories of the lives of the people he's trying to convert as well. And what I found really difficult in writing this chapter is I find what they're doing absolutely horrendous, preaching this false testimony that you can change your sexuality through the power of God. I just don't think that's real. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, a lot of these people have been through such grotesque trauma and abuse, that suffered physical violence from their parents, that'd been subjected to being overdosed on medication to cure them of their homosexuality, and in some cases that had affected their physical constitution.
Yes.
As well, that undergone electroshock therapy in the case of one woman that I spoke to, and now they were in a church and they felt they were getting better. Mm-hmm. And they felt they were at a place of peace. Mm-hmm. And what's really difficult to reconcile with is, in this cultural situation, maybe what they are saying is true, that of all the options that they could take, this might be the best of all.
Right.
And that's not actually saying these treatments work, but it's saying that of all their options, they're all grim, and this happens to be the best one for them. What does that actually tell us?
Or the least abusive, anyhow.
The least abusive, and what does that actually tell us about their lives and how trapped they must be? It was a really strange and strange sequence of interviews to undertake.
I've had lots of experience over the years with people who have tried reparative therapy, and it's just the depth of their brokenness before the therapy is compounded after the therapy, and some people just never recover, just absolutely never recover. I mean, they just go to a place where there is no affective life at all. There's no, you know, feeling of love or lust or any of that kind of stuff for anybody. It's just, it's really, really sad. We do terrible, terrible things to people.
And I think often what happens, at least from the people that I spoke to, is a lot of these reparative therapies, whether it is through medication, through electroshock, through religion as well, is it doesn't actually change their sexuality. What it does is it makes them numb.
Yes.
That's what I often find, that they just are completely emptied of one vital part of themselves, and they lose vitality as well. That's the sad thing.
Yes. I was struck by an excerpt that you provide on the book's page on Amazon. You say, of all the continents, Asia is the gayest. Deep down, you should probably have your suspicions all along, and I'm here to tell you those suspicions are correct. Let's do the math. In one of the world's ten most populous countries, six of them, seven if you count Russia, are in Asia: China, India, Indonesia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Japan. Across the continent are close to 4 billion people, making Asia home to the majority of the world's people. So, doesn't it stand to reason that most of the world's queer people, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual folks, live in Asia too, sharing one hot, sweaty landmass and filling it with breathtaking examples of exotic faggotry? I would think so.
It's not exactly BBC documentary, is it?
But, you know, when I first read that, you know, Asia is the gayest continent, I just thought, well, come on, that's a silly thing to sell a book. And then, of course, it makes perfectly good sense.
I know.
I have this, and I suppose a lot of people in our audience have this cultural relativism going on, and you know, we think that, you know, our Western cultures are the ones that, you know, are in the forefront, or are, you know, are doing the most, or are the most important, or the most advanced, and all of this kind of stuff. You know, it's really sad that we have this, and I apologize for it in myself, but it's true. You know, what you say is true.
But at the same time, you know, the West, and especially the United States, has been at the forefront of those gay fights as we know them. I think Stonewall, for instance, was this turning point, not
yes.
just for the States, but
yes.
but for the world. The
yes.
fact that queer people, one, existed, two, had a consciousness and a community, and three, could actually fight back as a mobilized group.
Right.
And I think what that did is it provided some sort of template or historical context that other people could refer to. Now, other countries will never have their Stonewall moment because, for instance, in China, you can't protest in China. You can't have that sort of
right.
Stonewall march or moment because it would just result in a whole lot of people getting arrested and detained, and the rest of the country also believing that they should be
right.
as well. But people always talk about these different moments, and I think they're very helpful. Like, for instance, even where I come from in Australia, I wasn't aware that other people in India, for instance, talk about Australia for what they're trying to do with gay men and HIV in India. They're like, you know, what we're trying to do is introduce the Australian model of tackling HIV. And when I ran around Asia, I was like, wow, I didn't even know Australia was held in that high regard. But
yeah.
Australia was seen, you know, when the United States and the UK were trying to contain an epidemic. Australia was the first nation where the government actually liaised with the most at-risk groups, homosexual men, intravenous drug users, and sex workers, and said, we're going to actively engage with you, educate you, so you educate your communities. Meanwhile, everyone else in the world was trying to, you know, criminalize homosexuality further and drive everyone underground. So there are, you know, because the West got their models of modern gay consciousness first and had to deal with HIV on a much greater scale first and foremost, you know, it is fair to say that in some cases, in some countries, they're very aware of these things. And because we're so globalized now, we exchange information. And of course, those exchanges aren't just one way. So it's not always a bad exchange.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Stonewall riots here in New York, and I mean that fits America. I mean, that was a very American sort of thing to do. You know, to try to transplant that, or, you know, make that as a model, you know, even for modern gay rights in any other country, especially countries in Asia, I mean, that you know, that would be cultural imperialism that, you know, I think would do them a injustice. But I suspect that, you know, there are thoughtful, reflective, you know, consciousness-raising kinds of people in all of the cultures that you visit, all the countries you've visited, and they're trying to make, you know, things happen that fit how they live.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, you go to India and there are groundbreaking queer figures over there that no one outside of India would know about. They've got their big sort of gay pioneers over there who are still very much alive as well and doing their work.
Yes.
And there's a lot of debate and discussion. At the same time, you know, it is a global discussion as well.
Mm-hmm.
And people do draw strength and inspiration from each other. So that, for instance, you know, a lot of the grants that are given to LGBT groups in Asia don't come from within Asia, of course. That's never going to be something that's awarded to them from government or even commercial sectors. But there are plenty of grants that come from overseas organizations that help them. So even though there are negatives, positives come out of that, you know, cross-oceanic exchange too.
Right. Very little time left. How did all this travel and writing about this sensitive subject affect your life and your social conscience?
You know, it did change it in a lot of ways. I think I came, for starters, I think I came back from a lot of these countries, like, for instance, in Myanmar. I think I came back quite rattled as well. There's a sense of helplessness sometimes where you realize whatever fights that we have in Australia, in the West, there are so many more fundamentally important fights in other countries where lives are literally at stake. When I was over in Myanmar, 1 out of 5 HIV-positive people who will need to get onto antiretroviral medication simply won't be able to access it. That's a huge number of people. But it also made me very grateful and want to expand the conversation further. There is a writer in Australia who's considered the godfather of the gay rights movement. His name's Dennis Altman, and he wrote a book that was quite groundbreaking across the world called Homosexual Oppression and Liberation. And he often talks in public events about this idea of our gay brothers and sisters. We are a community, but often we think of ourselves as a community contained with our country, whereas, you know, our queer family is global, and the thing that binds us together doesn't have any geographical boundaries. Those lesbians who undergo corrective rapes in African countries, people in India still fighting for their rights to have homosexuality decriminalized, they are part of our community.
Right.
Even
it's so
if you
true.
Have
it is so, so true.
So that's been the fundamental shift for me, remembering that you do belong to an LGBT community, but that's not just contained within your own circle of friends.
Right. Your own ethnic group. You know, it's splintered here in the United States. I suspect it also happens elsewhere. You know, white folks and black folks and brown folks and yellow folks. I mean, it's a different kind of thing altogether. And, you know, we splinter here because, you know, the things that once bound us together no longer do. A couple things. I wanted to ask you about The Family Law, which is your debut book, but our time is up, and so we're going to have to come back to that at some point. But I do, before we go, could you tell us about the research you're doing now and why you're doing it?
Well, I'm starting this next book project is very much in its infancy. I don't think it's even an embryo yet. I think it's more like a zygote. But I am going to be researching sex education models throughout the world and compare them. And I want to look at the people who teach sex education and what drives them and how their model of education affects the people that they teach. So if you have any interesting stories, please get in touch. Again, my website is benjamin-law.com, and all my contact details are there. But I've always been interested in these stories. I think it's such a pivotal point where we learn about how people reproduce the basics, fundamentals of life. But of course, it's such a politically charged field as well. How we teach children and what we teach them is often fraught.
Right. And sadly, you know, when we teach about sex, you know, we often teach anatomically and not about loving, which is
yes.
really an unfortunate kind of thing. There's a decoupling there, and that's been a bugaboo, it seems to me, for so many of us on the forefront of sex education here in the United States, because even things like homosexuality is all about sex and not about loving, and that is a problem, it seems.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that aren't emphasized. Like, I think protection is
yes.
always something that really needs to be focused
yes.
on, but we don't focus on pleasure.
Yes.
You know, we talk about consent for young girls, but are we talking about the fact that they should be enjoying what they like? Yeah.
Well, you're a joy. You are an amazing man. I love your book. It's so wonderful to have spent so much time with you this week and last. I wish you good luck, and I hope that we stay in contact, because I would love to have you on the show again.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Be well, and go knock 'em dead at your conference.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay, bye now. Great show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in next Monday when we visit with a brilliant filmmaker who will be here as part of the Sex Wisdom series, and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is the fabulous Fleshlight and Fleshjack. You know, all you guys out there who keep complaining to me about your short fuse? Well, here's a tip for you. Being a great lover, being able to control your orgasmic response and to last as long as you'd like, takes practice. Sure, you can learn to last longer simply by using your hand, but now there's an even more effective way to train yourself for sexual stamina and endurance with a partner. Allow me to introduce you to the Endurance Jack. It's just one of the fine designs from Fleshlight. It comes with the stamina insert, which has extra large bumps and a tight canal. With just a little practice with this puppy, you'll be able to last longer, gain control over your ejaculatory response, and avoid untimely climax. And once you've accomplished this with the Endurance Jack, you'll have all the skills you need to last and last with a partner. And remember, these fine products are made in the good old US of A. And if you make your purchase by clicking on the Fleshjack banner in the sidebar of DrDickSexAdvice.com, a portion of that sale will come back to us as support for these shows. Now you can help underwrite this important sex-positive effort and jerk off at the same time. How fun is that? Okay, until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.